So my name is Dr. Andy Cantor. I'm the immediate past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility of the National Board, as well as here in New York City, Physicians for Social Responsibility chapter. PSR is the largest physician-led organization that is dedicated to educating about and advocating to prevent the most gravest threats to human health and survival. And this includes nuclear weapons, climate change, toxic degradation of the environment. And full disclosure, PSR opposes nuclear power on several grounds, including the public health impact of the entire fuel cycle, the normal operations and accidents, and of course the linkage with nuclear weapons. PSR has been working on these issues for over 50 years. After our landmark publication in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1962, which highlighted the medical consequences of nuclear war. And PSR was the co-recipient of the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize with the International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War as its U.S. affiliate. It is important to note that as physicians and scientists in PSR and those who work with us, that we have no special vested interest for or against nuclear power. But we take our oaths to protect the public's health seriously, and we speak primarily with the medical voice. I think it's important to also understand that nuclear scientists and those who spend their entire lives working with radiation or whose livelihoods are dependent or associated with this technology are naturally going to have a different perspective and a different risk assessment from us. We should recognize this difference, but strive to find an objective approximation of the truth. What is clear, however, is that as a species, we have tended to choose expediency and short-term benefit over the longer-term responsibility to our ecosystem and to future generations. It used to be that it appeared that we had the luxury of doing what we wanted to satisfy our own needs for growth or development, or simply to satisfy our desires. We could take what we wanted and throw away anything we wanted to. And we just assumed that we would always have enough fuel or commodities or the great big ocean or the wide atmosphere would just swallow up our waste and our hubris. Now, in this Anthropocene age, we know that this is no longer true, and it never was true. We have failed to see the implications of our actions, and they have threatened not only our existence, but the very existence of life on this planet. So it is in this light that we must look at our choices for energy production. We must weigh carefully the risks and benefits, and we must seek to include all of the externalities. For nuclear power, this includes the medical and public health consequences of the entire fuel cycle, from the mining and enriching of the nuclear fuel, its transport, operations in the nuclear reactors, their inevitable accidents and releases, and then the reprocessing, waste disposal, and the proliferation of fissile materials and production of nuclear weapons. It is no longer acceptable to continue with the status quo. We must shake loose the shackles of the old ways that have bound us to a course that will lead to our inevitable destruction and do as Einstein demanded, adopt a new way of thinking if we are to survive. Now, I just returned from an actually exhilarating meeting in Oslo, Norway, where civil society, along with 132 countries of like-minded national governments, came together to discuss the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons. This is going to be followed up by a meeting in Mexico City, because the status quo has led to insufficient progress on reducing the threat from nuclear weapons. And this new track, similar to the Ottawa landmines or Oslo cluster munitions processes, seeks to ban and eliminate nuclear weapons. Not as President Obama said, sometime in the future, but in my lifetime. It is essential for all of society to be educated on nuclear power and the nuclear fuel cycle if we are to advocate from truth and provide a prescription for a safe, healthy, and sustainable future. This morning, we have two excellent panels of experts who are going to discuss the accidents at Chernobyl and Fukushima and what this means for nuclear power in the United States and generally. And I'm hoping that this information, along with yesterday's fact-filled presentations, will help us guide policy and implications for the United States as well as the rest of the world. And now to get on with the panel, and you didn't come here to hear me speak, I'm going to introduce the first speaker, who we've already heard a great deal about already yesterday, Dr. Alexei Yablokov from the Russian Academy of Sciences, whose extensive collection of Chernobyl publications was recently published by the New York Academy of Sciences. Dr. Yablokov.
I am proud to be here and express my vision, my understanding of the Chernobyl situation. 24 years ago, it was Mikhail Gorbachev who asked me to chair the Committee of Ecology of Soviet Parliament. I was Soviet parliamentarian. I immediately understand that Chernobyl is the number one environmental catastrophe in Soviet Union. And later, Gorbachev accept that from Chernobyl, it was start to collapse of Soviet Union. After collapse of Soviet Union, I was advisor to the Russian president. That time it was Boris Yeltsin, who also support my, not investigation, my not study, but my activity to dig the truth about Chernobyl. Short presentation is impossible to explain all detail. I tried it main problem. What such evolution of official point of view? Immediately after Chernobyl, in several months, in several days, all officials, international and national, Soviet Union, predict no immediate dangers, just absolutely the same like in Fukushima. No immediate dangers. It's a, like slogan. No elevating of cancer risk. Later, in several years, they accept that total death toll will be about 9,000 and number of sick about 200,000 for Chernobyl generation up to from 1986 to 2056. Now, UN scare discuss not established but discuss incident of thyroid cancer, leukemia, solid cancer as whole, cardiovascular mortality, cataract, at autoimmune system. It happened under our pressure when we published a lot of paper. All Chernobyl literature, scientific literature, I think about 30, maybe 35,000 published papers. It's impossible to review all of this paper in detail. I know about 5, maybe 6,000 of this paper. All this prediction based on invalid concept of average effective dose. What is my understanding now? It was dose conception, when we calculate any dose, it's a trick which profitable only for nuclear industry. How possible real estimate the dose during first day and week, when the level of irradiation after any nuclear catastrophe, 1,000, maybe million times higher than it happened in 1 month, in 2 months, it's impossible. How is possible to estimate consequences of hot particles? How it possible to patch contamination? Any contamination, radioactive contamination is patchy, spotted. It's impossible to calculate it exactly. How it possible to calculate dose from all radionuclide, not only from cesium, not only from strontium, but from many. Look for this picture. This is during the first day, first month, combination of radionuclide. It was about 60 or 70 different radionuclide. It was not cesium and not strontium who was the highest level of radiation during first day. Later, they changed this combination and so on, so on. How it possible to estimate influence of each radionuclide by dose conception? Impossible, simple impossible. Look for this, this is a Greek, especially not for Russia, because for Russia, for Ukraine, for Belarus, we have 100 of such pictures, but it's Greek. Greek, and this is argentum. Look, not cesium, not strontium, argentum, argentum.
Silver.
Yeah.
Silver.
Huh?
Silver.
Silver, sorry. Argentum is the Latin name. Yeah, and this is cesium. So look, patchy, at patchiness from silver differ from patchiness from cesium. How it possible to correctly apply the average weighting coefficient for calculation of dose? All dose is not real data. It's calculation. It's calculation by some presumption. One of the presumptions, you have average weight coefficient for skin, one coefficient for brain, other coefficient for lung, third coefficient. So it's absolutely unrealistic. It's average, it looks like average temperature for hospital. Next big discrepancy for dose, it's average consumption. Average consumption for air, average consumption for water, average consumption for food, it's impossible. It's impossible. All dose calculations for Belarusian people based on real calculation for 1.1% people. It's absolutely non-representative. Maybe I remind that all data for DOS based on the uniform phantom. Means healthy white man, age 20 years. How many healthy white men among us, among people who are suffering from radiation? It's zero, near to zero. Also, in Chernobyl, in Fukushima now, we have a lot of falsification. In Soviet Union, it was official secrecy up to 3.5 years after catastrophe. If we have special, we know document, one of this document here, when Ministry of Public Health have special order to change the medical data. Never put in the record the truth about Chernobyl, about radiation consequences. How is it possible based on this data? Impossible. Main postulate of average effective dose concept contradicts a large volume of data. The individual effective equivalent dose is the main criteria for World Health Organization and other organizations could not be efficient for estimation of real level of irradiation of people. But what we what we can do? How obtain real information? We have data. We have such way. Morbidity of population, having identical background, physical, environmental, and so, and difficult, and differ only in radioactive contaminated on its territory. And health of the same group of individual, which study in different time after catastrophe, in 1 year, in 10 years, in 20 years, the same group of people. The health of the same individual in regard to disorders which connected, strongly connected only with irradiation, like stable chromosome aberration. So we have scientific approach to collect data. We have it. Nuclear scientists reject this approach, but I used it. It published, first of all, it, this book, Chernobyl Consequences, first time was published in St. Petersburg in year 2007. After this, it was published in New York Academy of Science, and after this, it's published in Kyiv last year. Well, 2 years ago, and now in maybe in one month, it will be published in Tokyo, in large edition. So I think it's the most up-to-date independent review of Chernobyl consequences. It's reflect, I think, about 5,000 papers, maybe 6,000 papers, but it's give us the true picture. Several examples. Solid cancer incidents in the province which heavy contaminated at the upper curve. This is heavy contaminated province, Russian province, Bryansk province. This is less contaminated, and this is average for Russia. Visible, no other reason for such differences in cancer rate, only Chernobyl consequences. We don't know what exact radionuclide affect Bryansk province, but we have result. We have result. This is cancer dynamic of thyroid cancer morbidity after Chernobyl in Belarus and Ukraine. You can see all when we compare. When we compare a less contaminated and more contaminated area, immediately we have effect. Nobody explained this outside of Chernobyl. Only Chernobyl, nothing more. No reason for such a differences between populations. This is dynamic of thyroid cancer in Greece and Romania. The same, I also take this country outside of Soviet Union because we have a lot of data for Soviet Union, many. But even here, we have papillary form of cancer much jumped after Chernobyl. No other explanation, only Chernobyl. Breast cancer, the same situation. The area with low level contamination have low level of cancer, and area with high level of contamination have a rising after in what is this in 10 years after Chernobyl jumped exactly is in the textbook. In 10 years after Chernobyl, this cancer have to arise. It will happen in Fukushima also, absolutely, I am sure. This is example of awful picture. We have several, I don't know, not exact data, but it's typical malformation. Professor Vertilevsky will be discussing it in detail, I hope, but we have such a huge, maybe several hundred every year additional such people. And this is lens opacity. It's not cataract. Cataract accept, even nuclear scientists accepted cataract. Yes, one of the reasons for irradiation is lens opacity. Look, what has happened. Strong correlation between body burden, how many becquerel in body, and how many lens opacity in eye in children. This is prevalence of trisomy, Down syndrome. It's great similarity between West Berlin. Berlin is here, and this is Belarusia. It's interesting approach, Sperling and Professor Sperling. Look, after Chernobyl, the level of these illnesses slightly differ from previous they called it stick, broken stick model. Broken stick model. It's interesting for many illnesses. The same situation. This is such a combination all data. What we have, what disorder we have with Chernobyl? Practically all system: blood, endocrine, immune, urogenital tract, skeletal system, so on. Every system have some visible consequences after low level irradiation, which continue many years. Among consequences of Chernobyl, premature aging, even children became similar with some elder people. So it's aging. Mutation, of course, change of sex ratio. Some German statistics calculate that about 1 million girl, less 1 million girl after Chernobyl consequences on the total world, on the globe. Officials and nuclearists usually insist that it's psychological factor, radiation phobia. Yesterday, Professor Mousseau very visibly explained what is a psychological factor for barn swallow and some other animals. Continue. What radiation phobia for frogs, for pine tree, which we have this similar broken chromosome and so on. This is several examples. Very difficult to calculate miscarriage. The level of many journalists ask me what the consequences in Chernobyl in the death, how it calculate. Very difficult. First of all, miscarriage, a lot of miscarriage, maybe 100,000 miscarriage all over the globe was after Chernobyl. The same situation in Fukushima, I am sure. Look for this, it deviant for infant mortality. It's just statistical data, it's nothing more. What we can see the jump after Chernobyl catastrophe, some jumped in infant mortality. This is Germany and this is Poland, but we have the same data for any country. I ask Alfred Korblein, it's a wonderful statistician from Germany, from München, collect data for me. He immediately he take the statistical, official statistical data. Look for this. This is Switzerland. After Chernobyl, unexplained level of rising of child mortality. The same in Finland. The same for any European country. The same. No explanation, only Chernobyl. Look for this latest data for Fukushima. I know that Jan Farley will be, after me, will be detailed discuss the situation. I just show this. After the same, like after Chernobyl, we have here jumped, unusual, statistically detectable, jumped in infant mortality for all Japanese population, not for vicinity of Fukushima, but for all. If we study vicinity of Fukushima, it will be more visible absolutely. Some St. Petersburg statistician try to collect data about mortality in heavy contaminated area, heavy contaminated after Chernobyl. This is heavy contaminated 6 Russian province and less contaminated, situated near to heavy contaminated. Differences, you see, statistically very strong differences. The data after 15 years, it looked like 4% additional death rate, 4%. This similar data I catch from Ukraine and from Belarus, 4% and 3% and 7%, something about 4%. For the first 15 years after Chernobyl, the total mortality decreased in heavy contaminated area, like in Fukushima, 4%. It means if we calculate it more and more for all of Chernobyl fallout. By the way, bulk of Chernobyl fallout go away from Soviet Union. Soviet Union received only about 40% of Chernobyl radionuclide. 60% received Europe, Africa, Asia, even United States. So if you calculate step by step, it looks like about Chernobyl death toll for 15 years, about 800,000. Many nuclear scientists blame me for this data. I ask them, please show me where my calculation is wrong. No one never show me some mistake in my calculation. If all animals, plant, and microorganism have the height level of change in contaminated area, it's impossible to say about phobia and psychological factor and something else. No, the same. The main Chernobyl lesson: the nuclear industry raise the same risk to our planet with nuclear power, not only theoretically, but practically, in the same level risk for humanity and the Earth at whole as a nuclear weapon. Thank you very much.
Спасибо большое. Really nice to hear things that we don't often hear because of our language or geography. I think it was very important also to come back to a message that came from yesterday as well, which Dr. Yablokov alluded to, which is that the results depend on the assumptions. And if the assumptions do not include all of the known data, you will get erroneous results. So now I'd like to introduce Dr. Vladimir Verletsky, who is the former chair of the Department of Medical Genetics at the University of South Alabama. He's going to speak on congenital malformations in Rovna associated with the Chernobyl accident. And this is where my great-grandparents came from, so I'm very interested.
To start, I would like to thank very much the colleagues who organized this meeting, in particular Dr. Helen Aldicott, and also the press for expressing their interest by being present. This presentation is a little bit out of the main type of presentations you have heard. And it's a little bit technically complicated, so forgive me if I over or under aim my explanations. For those who know the subject, it may be too simple, and for those who are not very much in the line of this kind of work, it may not be clear, so please look me up. In any event, this is to stress that this is not a first observation. This is the third analysis and is the very first time after 10 years where we start letting some results out, because the issue is credibility. It's not the data, but it's the credibility of the data. For a general, those who teach and have students or young researchers, I think the news releases by the WHO or the IAEA are masterpieces of language manipulation. So I would like to call your attention that IAEA now is basically behind WHO, so their declarations now are given to the young people in the name of the World Health Organization, to which they should trust. Because if they don't trust the World Health Organization, then how can they trust much else? So the last one was in February 28th. And notice the similarities and the little nuances that are different. And one of those that I will show, the 205 declaration, is that now low-dose radiation appears as an if. And also the 100 millisieverts, the 100 gold standard, now appears to be lower. But all of that is sort of a nuanced thing. And if you read further, now reduction of exposure is important. While in 205, in Kiev, they said, the whole delegation told the Ukrainian government to cut off all the programs that minimized exposures to about 250,000 people. So I will start. This work required cooperation of many people, many more than I can mention, and you can find out what is this OmniNet in the web. And it involves international and Ukrainian colleagues. Now, here essentially is to point out that we have participants in the international group that are most of them focused on alcohol, because alcohol is a teratogen, and a teratogen is any cause, environmental cause, that can create malformations or developmental problems. And in Ukraine, alcohol is a fairly common universal teratogen. So if you don't take that into account, you're going to get confused with another universal teratogen, which is ionizing radiation. Among others, there are cultural anthropologists, mathematicians, people interested in statistics, nutrition, psychology, and so on. So we did what we could, and most of that is done pro bono. And if not pro bono, none of it is done connected with government or the nuclear power industry. I also want to tell you that data is data, and good data is good data, and the gold standard is this one. It's the Hiroshima-Nagasaki studies by Dr. James Neal. And it's not only about cancer and cancer and cancer, it is also about congenital malformations. But I want to stress that these studies are not about teratogens. They are about gene mutations, which is completely different to what we are going to be talking about. I also want to point out that the radiation model, in our view, from Hiroshima Nagasaki is irrelevant to the Chernobyl situation, because the ionizing radiation in Rivne is chronic, not acute. It's not a blast, but it's a continuous drip. It's not gamma or neutrons, but it's mainly beta type of radiation. It is not external, but it is inhaled or swallowed. And the people that were studied that then had children 2 years later in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, those parents were exposed to radiation, but their children that were conceived in a radiation-free environment. Nobody in his right mind went down to the hypocenter to conceive a child. All these people conceived children after Hiroshima, Nagasaki. So we referred to a release of IAEA in 2005, but actually the data was already done in 1995, and since then it has been pounding the same message. So one of our contributor, was Dr. Anspo, who very kindly explained to me, because I don't understand this process, of how this enormous committee came up with these things. And this is the release, more or less, in the shape of 10 years later, and notice a little bit of nuance difference. So it is sort of presumptuous to say you're not going to find something. So presumptions are a little bit a derogatory term. But in any event, it freezes, or at least it makes it very chilled environment to say, well, I want to take a look. So we convened a meeting exactly on the 5th anniversary of the Ukrainian independence. This is 1996, World Congress of Human Genetics, and we invite Dr. Anspo, we invite Dr. Neal, we talk to Dr. Joseph Warkany, who is the founder of teratology. By the way, that's his etching. It's called Hiroshima Shadows Without Men, and so on. And we decide to explore the possibility. Dr. Lazuk from Belarus, Dr. Barilak represented the Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. We got together in Rio de Janeiro. We put in, you know, a couple of sources of funding, and we decided to try. Well, as you know, there is a situation of power change. After Chernobyl, 5 years later, Ukraine decided to leave the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapses. There is a creation of a new government. There's a power struggle between points of view. And in that environment, we tried to start an international program based on international standards to establish a population registry of every child born and every child examined. And that started in 2000. Now, the terms Chernobyl you already know. Polisia is a region of Rivne. Polishchuks are the native people from Polisia. And Rivne is one of the 28 provinces of Ukraine. And we decided that we need to use international standards, so we said, okay, we're going to join the European Congenital Malformation Monitoring System, and we're going to make Ukraine a member of that system, and they are welcome to come and check the data. So we established teams across Ukraine, and slowly, to quickly accumulate data, we were doing population monitoring, still do, in more than one province. And here is the cloud, and there is Rivne. And on the north, the northern half of the province is called Polisia. And further north is the river Pripyat, which you have heard before. And we quickly notice that there is a departure of certain rates. And if you look at neural tube defects, Eurocat reports 10.2, we begin to see 18.5. And we notice anencephaly goes higher, and microcephaly is higher, and anophthalmia is higher. So it's a hypothesis. Let's then see what we can do. Let's put our very limited resources and crank it up. Then we realized that maybe we should concentrate on the dirtiest of the provinces. So we publish here and there, and we study Polish chooks, and we put something in human biology because the population isolate, and they may be inbred, and they look like Cajuns in Louisiana and so on. And here's the province. The northern half of the province geologically is different. It has no clay, virtually, no binders. So the radiation that fell, plus the index of transfer of that radiation to woods, to trees, to nutrients, to grass, is so much higher that, in effect, this is more contaminated than Zhytomyr, which is right next to Chernobyl. So this is the most contaminated area in Ukraine. And we also noticed that the northern three counties are of particular interest. They are the most isolated, and I will come back to that. And they have seasonal flooding, just like in Louisiana. And that gives legs to a lot of radiation. It can move. So it's an ecologic isolate, it's a population isolate. As an isolate, they marry each other. And it has the highest index of transfer of cesium from soil to plant. And they have to eat or die from hunger because they can't go anywhere to buy food. They can't go anywhere to heat or else they freeze, so they burn radioactive wood. So, to summarize, special population, special ecology, special radiation, well, we have a real niche. Ideal for multidisciplinary long-term studies of health impacts of anything. So we are not after selling that radiation is the only problem. We don't want children with congenital malformations, whatever the cause. So after confirmation, we are now starting this sort of presentations. And I'm going only to talk about Polisia and Rivne, and only to talk about two or three anomalies, because as you know, there are 500 of them. And we did, at the same time, surveys to try to narrow down what could be the cause. But this is description. This is descriptive epidemiology, which is not designed to prove cause-effect. It is only designed to prove what's going on. So, we know that the neural tube defects in Polisia are the highest in Europe. And that's up to Eurocat to say no. They are funded by the European Union to do exactly that. We also know that microcephaly is the highest in Europe. And so is microphthalmia. Three anomalies that are known to be associated with either alcohol or with either or both ionizing radiation. But there are little differences. So naturally, we were very lucky to have one of the longest NIH-funded projects to detect early as possible, fetal alcohol syndromes before birth of these children. So we start with teratogenic risks. Let's start with alcohol. That's where the money is. That's where the bank is. That's where the NIH pays for people to do, so we do. And we conclude that that cannot be an explanation of what we see in Polisia. So we see a couple of thousand women at considerable effort. We screen them, and we demonstrate that actually in Polisia, these women that are pregnant drink much less, not much more, than the other women that live in different cities. Secondly, we look at where do we find FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and we find many more elsewhere. So the rates are higher away from Polisia than in Polisia. So we now look at radiation. Well, we don't have money, we don't have expertise, you are the experts, we are just plain pediatricians. We are pedestrian pediatricians. So, but we know that radiation has legs and they get mobilized regularly. The fires occur every summer. One kind of tree has 20 times as much radiation per kilogram than another kind of tree, so there's no point in generalizing. A burning pine is different from a burning willow. Different organisms. And we know that this averaging out doesn't tell you a thing. It's a trick, indeed, I agree. The averaging out tricks are not good enough for a mother of a child with a congenital malformation. And 76% of them heat and cook by burning wood and then take the ash and fertilize their little home garden. So they keep concentrating and concentrating. So actually the concentrations are higher now than they were 15 years ago. Because the bioconcentration takes time. And so the pregnant women do the easy task. They go and burn dried potato stems. The potato harvest is do or die. Potato is a central element of nutrition. And if you're old enough, sit home and burn radioactive wood and stay warm and cook potato pancakes. And you can go and get blintzes here in New York, in the Carnegie Deli, and they're terrible, so don't order them. Just take a look at them. So what do? We collect these plants and look at what's in them. So if a woman can incorporate radiation, can a potato? I presume it can incorporate. So we look, and to our surprise, we find strontium. We don't believe it. We run it again. And there it is. So we have a ratio of how much cesium to strontium. But all the measures and all the public health is based on cesium. We ignore strontium, and strontium for a fetus is much more important than we believe, because potassium is everywhere, but strontium has to go to specialized enzymes and skeletons and teeth and dentin and all kinds of other things, and it's going to stay with that child until it dies. So it's going to be radiating. The potassium, they'll be urinating it out, the cesium. But the strontium, once you got you, it stays where it is. Now, I'm not going to repeat that, but anyhow, we take a couple of thousand people, 20,000 people, 20,000 measurements of whole body counts. It's a little bit, a lot of work. And we find that 48% of women in those three counties are above what the Ministry of Health says is safe. So, here it is. Now, how sensitive is a fetus? Shall we compute a woman as an adult, although she is pregnant, or shall we focus on the sensitivity of the fetus? I don't know of a single citation, if you do, please give me, of what is the sensitivity of a fetus. We say a child has 3,800 becquerels upper limit, and an adult 11,453 and three quarters. But how much does the fetus have? So here we are stuck. We did not expect to find things. We simply followed the lead. And now we have microcephaly, not alcohol. It can be due to all kinds of things, from abracadabra to the moon to whatever have you. This is descriptive epidemiology. But also has to be logical. So let's check. Maybe we miss minor effects, minor reductions of the head size. Because we did a very strict definition of microcephaly of three standard deviations or less. Otherwise, you are not microcephalic. You can be very, very retarded and have epilepsy and have a very small head. But if it's not three standard deviations, we don't count you. But now let's do the other way. Let's measure all the heads. So this is a comparison of about 15,000 measurements at birth. And to our surprise, no difference in birth weights, but a statistically significant reduction of head size in those three counties. And what are you going to do with that? This is subclinical, probably, I don't know. Probably these children, you won't distinguish them from anyone else. But it's known radiation effect on the nervous system. So let's look beyond Ukraine. Well, there are studies by very reputable epidemiologists. They were then working at the CDC, and they go to Hanford, and they do a first study, and they find neural tube defect elevations, and they dismiss it because of whatever reason. Good reasons, but nonetheless, they are good scientists, so they repeat the study. And they confirm the study. Different approach. And they dismiss it again fundamentally because it contradicts the Hiroshima-Nagasaki observations. Not because of the inherent flaw of the study, but it doesn't make sense in the context of the golden standard. But the golden standard had nothing to do with teratology. It had to do with heritable forms of microcephaly. These are environmentally induced microcephalies. It's not that the gene came in and said, don't make the brain. No, the genes were fine, but the radiation said, die and reduce your size. So it's comparing apples and pears. And then there is a study in Sellafield. An editor from a reputable journal one time said, I misquoted it, and I said, you better read it again. Because these are very subtle paragraphs here and there, but nonetheless, the most common anomaly among the most common are neural tube defects, and there it is. But, you know, there were a lawsuit about leukemia clusters near Sellafield and so on. The atmosphere was very charged. This study was not repeated. Then Eurocat does two studies, but doesn't study anybody near Chernobyl. Okay, only Western Europe, way out there. And good, bad, or indifferent, they say that we don't see anything. This is the path of the radiation and circling around England. And when we compare the actual rates that Eurocat reports, to our surprise, yes, Police region is the highest, but so is Northern England, Wales. And we can see the highest rate, the second highest rate, the third highest rate, and we keep finding these regions in Wales and Northern England. I don't report those data. Those regions report the data. They don't report to me, they report to Eurocat, and we report to Eurocat, and supposedly we are trying to use the same methods, but it is imprudent to statistically compare these things, because still there are a lot of confounding factors that one didn't explore, but simply it's an informational piece. And Dr. Yablokov and many others have pointed out that mental health is a big problem. Is part of the radiation syndrome. So in Sweden there are studies, and in Norway there are studies that show that those who were in utero at the time in the center of those two countries independently, they find cognitive deficiencies. So that is consistent with that subclinical reduction of the head that I was showing you before. So we have arrived basically at the end of the trip. So, what do? We cannot say that this study is cause and effect. This study is a descriptive study. But we do provide a foundation for cause and effect. We have a specific population, we have a specific pattern of malformations, and we have a specific geographic area. Rather than running around and reassembling the liquidators and getting at random a bunch of mix-up ethnologies and different varieties of people and then extrapolating results. We have a population registry of every baby born in the last 10 years with name of the mother and everything else. So, what do we conclude? Either we are not talking about reality and I wouldn't be here. We waited for three analyses, and I think that from our side, that's not so. Now, those who think that this is unreal, whether they are IAEA or whoever, they are welcome to come and check the data. Or these malformations are there, but they are not due to radiation. So that those whole body counts of pregnant women and potatoes and all that, that's totally irrelevant. Prove it. Let's prove it. I think that's important enough to dismiss it with some prospective case control or whatever other epidemiologic studies you wish. Not this one. This one opens the key and the door to facilitate and expedite such an investigation. Or maybe the fetus is far more sensitive than the standards we apply to it. And finally, maybe actually the doses are not what they said to be. And probably all of these factors, plus alcohol, plus malnutrition, plus lack of folate acid, and plus of so many birth defects, congenital malformations, require the convergence of two things. Multiple things that disrupt the development, and multiple things that disrupt the repair of the damage, because we have regenerative capabilities. So you have this balance, and if it is unbalanced, then the morphogenesis of the embryo becomes altered. So I did not talk about conjoined twins, but that's what we see. I did not talk about teratomas, that is what we see. I did talk a little bit about neural tube defects, but there are many subcategories and associations. I did talk with microcephaly, and I did not touch much about microphthalmia, but there are all kinds of things that the world needs to know, because these birth defects occur in China and Indonesia, India, and anywhere else, and the more we know, the better we're going to prevent them. So what I want to tell you is that as a physician, prevention is first, not epidemiology. And we know how to prevent. We know that in China, this is J.R. Berry, a good friend, who spent part of his life, his children went to school in China in order to do this, that he proved conclusively that you can reduce 50% or more neural tube defects by one pill that costs, you can get about 60 pills for 60 days for the price of one pack of cigarettes. And we can't find the pills. So it is an immediate need to act. And we have been working with the government, and yes, tomorrow, yes, tomorrow, yes, tomorrow. It needs to be done, I agree. But secondly, these people don't need to be exposed to radiation because they don't need to swallow it. Give them milk, give them potatoes, give them flour, but bring it from somewhere else. Then we know about alcohol and campaigns about alcohol. And the authorities have enough resources and know-how to do it today. But if international partnerships step in, that's more likely, and it's more likely to be done better. And the existing monitoring can show, not just to Ukraine, but the world, all the nuances of prevention. For instance, is folic acid going to prevent neural tube defects when you have a bunch of people exposed to radiation, or is it going to be totally ineffective? And if it is effective, would it be effective in Fukushima, regardless if they have spina bifida or not? Should Fukushima-exposed people get folic acid? Those are questions that transcend Ukraine and call for solidarity. And Western Europe needs to learn a little bit more, because we are the only program unfunded by the European Union. There are 39 programs. We are the only ones who don't get a penny to monitor congenital malformations that they publish. And if Chernobyl is not relevant to Europe and congenital malformation threat, I'm confused. So here is the can-do principle that some people alluded to, and I want to dedicate this lecture to this little child. We detected her before she was born. I found her abandoned in a hospital because the mother wasn't even told that she had a living child. The mother was told, "You delivered a monster that was dead, and go home, forget it, try again." The mother got so depressed, she left the country. And here we have this little orphan that has no hip, no sex, no ovaries, no uterus, and full of joy of life. She ends up in an orphanage, and we find the grandma, who eventually comes and picks her up. The grandmother brings the mother. This child now is a high school graduate somewhere in Western Europe. It proves two points: we can do, but also their brain is spared, because these anomalies are very early ones, and if you don't die, you're going to develop everything else like everybody else. If the damage is late, regeneration is diminished, and you cannot restitute what you lose as much as if you start very early. Think of congenital twins. Every monozygotic twin is a congenital malformation that is perfect otherwise, but it's a malformation nonetheless. And that's a typical, from one I get exactly a copy of another. I regenerate me. So thank you for your attention, and I hope you join us.
Thank you, Dr. Vertolisky. I think it's always important to remember that we're talking about real people and that our consequences, both for good or for evil, affect real people. He also introduced, I think, or reintroduced two issues that are very important for us. One was brought up yesterday, which is the notion of an ecological half-life, that it's not just about looking at radionuclides and their decay rates or their biological effects, but how do they cycle within systems and ecologies, and how do they continuously re-expose us? And that the people that currently are doing most of these analyses are basing their assumptions and information using data that is not really relevant because these long-term chronic exposures are very different. And we must take that into account and address this issue, which was almost completely ignored in the most recent WHO report. So now I'm going to turn to Ian Fairley, who is a radiation biologist and independent consultant. He's spent more than 12 years working for the British government and is now retired, and is going to speak on the nuclear disaster at Fukushima, nuclear source terms, and initial health effects.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. How do I follow those two excellent speeches? Very moving indeed. First of all, I'd like to say thank you very much to Helen and to PSR for organizing this great symposium. I'm going to be discussing perhaps a couple of the most important aspects of Fukushima. One is the source term, what happened, what came out, and secondly, I'm going to make a stab at trying to estimate some of the health effects from the fallout from Fukushima. This is what I'm going to be discussing. I'm going to be looking at some photos of the disaster, some maps of the fallout dispersion, some of the chat about some of the source terms, although there's quite a lot of question about them. And then I'm going to be going on to the health effects, initial health effects, which we're already seeing, and what to expect in the future. And then I'm going to finish with collective doses. Yesterday afternoon, David Remner came and talked about the importance of population doses. That's the same thing as collective doses. This is the earthquake. March 2011. I'm going to run some. We've seen some of these before. This is Fukushima Daiichi. Is that better? This is the tsunami hitting Fukushima. That's been seen before. This one hasn't. This shows the height of the surge, over 130 feet high, hitting the seawall, and this shows the water surging through the plant. This is about 30 feet high, the water wall going through. These are photographs of the interior of the plant, showing the water, particularly in the bottom three slides, D, E, and F, submerging important equipment. On March the 12th, there was a explosion at the Unit 1. And March, 2 days later, March the 14th, an explosion at Unit 3. You can see it's quite different from the explosion. I'll just point out here this debris here is huge. And in a future slide, I'll show you what the effect is of this massive amount of debris going up. The next thing is that on March the 15th, and this is not really very clear, TEPCO do their best to try and hide this, but about just shortly after 6 o'clock in the morning, Japanese time, there was a quote-unquote explosive event in the fuel pond at Unit 2, and that was followed seconds later by another explosive event in the spent fuel pond at Unit 4. So these two events on the 15th were very, very intimately connected, and we don't know the reason why yet. And then the next day, on March the 16th, again, early in the morning, there was a major explosion at Unit 4. That's the fuel pond. Those two explosions on the 15th and 16th were not videotaped because it was dark and there was no TV crews actually taking footage at the time. This gives us a timeline of the various explosions. I should say, and I would sort of reflect what Arne Gunnarsson said, that there's a lot of questions yet. Many emissions and high radiation levels which are still unexplained. We're still only 2 years after the accident. We're still piecing things together. And TEPCO is running interference and making damn sure that we don't find out what's going on. But nevertheless, if we can look here at the damage to, we've seen some of these before. These are the damage to reactors 4, 3, 2, and 1. 4, 3, 2, and 1. And going on from the top, these are the reactors 3, 2, and 1. 3, 2, and 1. And you can see here, these holes and the turbine holes are a result of the falling debris from the reactor. These are huge holes, about 20, 30 feet in diameter, which means that big chunks of the reactor and or fuel pond went straight up into the air. And yes, you heard yesterday Arne Gunnarsson say that he thought that perhaps there was a criticality involved, but that was a minority view. Well, I share that view. It doesn't matter if it's a minority. There's quite a bit of evidence suggesting that something more than a hydrogen explosion took place. Of course, the officials, TEPCO and the Japanese government agencies, deny it. But there's far too much plutonium and uranium lying around the rest of Fukushima for there not to have been a criticality accident. Event, I should say. So we'll see in future what actually happens. Again, more the damage from to reactors 4 and reactor 3. So just to recap what happened. There was at least four explosions in the reactors at units 1, 2, and 3 and in the spent fuel pond at unit 4. There was overheating in the four spent fuel ponds, and there was a fire in Unit 4. There were core meltdowns in reactor in Units 1, 2, and 3, and we don't really know where the melted fuel is. It's probably at the basements of the 1, 2, and 3, but we're not absolutely sure. Many workers suffered very high radiation levels, 250 millisieverts plus, big evacuations as well. We'll go on to that. About 12,000, putting some numbers, 12,000 workers were exposed. About 100,000 people were evacuated. Lots of contamination of thin water. And about 8% of Japan's surface area was contaminated. These are the evacuation areas, color-coded so you can follow them. I think that rather than me discussing this in great detail, if you want to, you can download this or be given copies of it so you can study it at your leisure. but the pink, the green, and the purple areas all had different parameters about when and the numbers of people who were evacuated. Here again, more precise data about evacuation numbers and zones. This is a photograph, an image from surveys done by U.S. military, basically, of helicopters about 100 meters above surface, measuring cesium levels, both 134 and 137. And you can see here a distinct horseshoe-shaped pattern of deposition from the plumes at Fukushima. Also, you can see there's quite a lot of population centers. These are the purple-colored areas here. Oh, jeez. Here. These are high population areas. You say, well, why are you mentioning population areas? Because it's where there's high populations that you get the deaths. And it's where you get high population doses. It's people that count. If the radiation falls in an area where nobody lives, then we're perhaps less concerned. It shows some of the dose levels similar to the previous slide, but given some numbers of the doses. As you can see, as you can see here, we're talking about doses of up to millisieverts, 50 millisieverts a year. None of that is taken into account in the recent WHO report, which is a disgrace in many ways. But going on, this slide is on its side. I couldn't for the life of me get it to go up and down, north and south, but can you imagine this is... this is the curve here of the that I showed you before, the horse-shaped. Now, this is here is Greater Tokyo, a population of 35 million or so. And you can see that parts of Tokyo were contaminated. Now, even if the population of Tokyo only got an average dose of a millisievert, say, that's still a huge dose in terms of the population dose. It's 30,000 person sieverts. It's very large indeed. Just going on. It wasn't just Japan. It was the rest of the world. And this shows you the contamination as measured by Stoll and his associates in Norway. Stoll, he's an important person for you to try and remember his name, S-T-O-H-L. They used data from the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization measurement stations throughout the world. Makes me wonder why it didn't occur with Chernobyl, but anyway, they did it for Fukushima, and you can see the deposition throughout the rest of the world. Essentially, what this slide shows is that every single one of us has bought a reverse lottery ticket. Do you remember what David Brenner said yesterday about the fact that if you're spreading very small doses over a large population, it's basically a reverse lottery ticket. And like a real lottery ticket, some people are going to get it. Some either with an ordinary lottery ticket, you won the jackpot, but with a reverse lottery ticket, you die. We don't know who it is, and the risk could be, individual risk could be very small, but people will die. And that's why collective doses are really important to measure. We live in a society, in a capitalist society, where we value individual freedoms and individual rights and individual doses and put a lot of emphasis on it. Yeah, okay, but collective doses are important too. So if you pick up nothing else from this conference, please try and remember that we should try emphasize collective doses. And I'll give you another reason why, and that is that the World Health Organization and UNSCARE and IEA are all trying to downplay collective doses. Your response? Pick it up. It's important. The next slide is again by Stoll, and it's not very clear, but it's the best I've got. This is Japan again, here, and you can see that most of the cesium fell on the sea, on the Pacific Ocean. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm trying a bit of a comparison between Fukushima and Chernobyl, because it's by comparisons that you learn, you get an idea of where we are, get a handle on it. If you compare the two, the fallout from Chernobyl was over a much larger area in terms of high concentrations. Chernobyl was over land, not in the sea, whereas in Fukushima, about 80% of the cesium fallout was over the sea rather than land, only 20% over land. However, in Japan, the population densities were much higher than they were in Ukraine and Belarus and the Soviet Union. At Chernobyl also, we think that the source terms were larger. I'll come to that in a minute. So it gives you an idea of the differences and similarities between the two. This is a slide which most North Americans are not really aware, so I'm going to let you have a look at it. This is the depositions of cesium throughout Europe. In essence, ladies and gentlemen, Europe was clobbered. 60% of the fallout from Chernobyl fell on Western Europe. The highest concentrations were in Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia, but the actual amounts were spread throughout the whole of Western Europe. There's one slightly funny aspect in that, and that is if you look at France here, La Belle France, the French government announced that the Chernobyl fallout couldn't possibly land in France. It was the trouble. We can laugh at it now, but at the time they took it seriously. I kid you not. And when this data came out, the result was that a number of cabinet ministers had to resign. I kid you not. And another thing is that for those people who are students of irony, so to speak, is if you look at the UK. The highest doses that fell out from the plume fell on Sellafield. It's quite funny. But just going on a little bit, I'm going to look now at this area here in the next slide. This is it here. And this is Chernobyl. And you can see the concentrations which fell. These are high concentrations. An immediate area. Now, the next slide is going to be a bit of a shocker, but I hope you'll take it on the chin. I've superimposed Fukushima on top of the map that I showed you previously. It's the same scales. And the colors are roughly, again, to the same scale. So it gives you an idea of the respective sizes of the fallouts. Now, you're not just to take away from that Fukushima is not important. Of course it is. It's very serious indeed. It's just that Chernobyl was a catastrophe. And I use the word advisedly. Alexei used the word, and I totally agree. It was a catastrophe for the rest of Europe. And Japan's got its own one now. I'm not minimizing Japan at all. Fukushima at all. It's just that in the scale of things, Chernobyl was and is very bad. And I'm going to talk now a little bit about the source term. It's quite debatable. The most important nuclides are cesium from Fukushima. There's quite a bit of debate. Yesterday, Ken Busler showed there was a number of estimates. The Japanese ones were all about 10 petabecquerels instead of 36 from Fukushima. I hope you don't mind my using these words, of Peter Becquerel, is basically 15 zeros after one, a humongous amount, humongous amount of radioactivity. So that's it's a quadrillion disintegrations per second. That's pretty large. But anyway, if you look at the two cesium numbers here, they're 3.5 times what all the other official Japanese estimates were. But I don't believe the Japanese official estimates. I don't trust them one inch. So I tend to prefer the estimates by Stoll and his colleagues in Norway. Now, you may say, well, why do you believe, and that's from the Norwegian Radiation Protection Agency, why do you believe them? Well, Norway doesn't have any nuclear power stations. Okay, very important. And also, if you look at the Stoll didn't measure iodine, unfortunately. Here. And so I had to go for another data source, and I used the Austrian Environment Protection Agency data. Why did I use Austria? There's no nuclear power station in Austria. One of the things I've learned, I've been in this area for a long time, and one of the things I've found out, any country that's got nuclear power in it, the information data sources are contaminated. A couple of points also from this slide is that you'll see that radioactive noble gas xenon 133, half-life of about 5 days. Actually, more was emitted from Fukushima than Chernobyl, mainly because there was 3 reactors that went up, whereas at Chernobyl there was 1. These data show very roughly that what I had shown earlier, that the effect from Fukushima was about an order of magnitude lower than the effect from Chernobyl. Now, this is an interesting slide, which I said to you that Chernobyl was really, really bad. Hey, guess what was worse? I'll let you look at it for a second. The important is the x-axis, which gives you the time. The years 1960, or 55, 60, 65, guess what happened then? You got it. It was the atmospheric bomb tests. And you can see that it put out a huge amount of cesium into the atmosphere. In 1986, you had Chernobyl, which was short, sharp, and sweet, 10 days, followed by, as you can see, the body burden of cesium there. And this is becquerels per millibecquerels per square, or cubic meter, or so in the air. The trouble is that not many people really study the effects of atomic bomb tests, but they are serious. Going on. In February 28th this year, I think it was timed to sort of negate the anniversary meetings and conferences for the second anniversary of Fukushima. They rushed the report out. In fact, there's a number of typos in it. I don't know if you've seen it. Anyway, the WHO report said that there was little bits of little increases in breast cancer and leukemia amongst people who were near Fukushima, but a big increase in women of thyroid cancer risks. That's probably the case. However, I think that breast cancer and leukemia incidences actually may be bigger than this. Again, WHO report is very vague. It said risk for predicted to be low, no discernible increase outside of Japan, which is nonsense, and a third of emergency workers have increased risks. Wow. So what? I mean, the thing is that you should try and get numbers to these, and they haven't done it. Anyway, having put down the WHO report, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we can expect to happen at Fukushima, unfortunately, using Chernobyl as a guide. An initial 9 month period after March the 11th, 2011, we can expect to see teratogenic effects, in other words, effects from exposures in utero to embryos and fetuses, and then listed there. After 2 years, we expect to see leukemias increasing in adults, but they are really hard to pick up because leukemia is a relatively rare disease. After 4 years, we expect to see increases in thyroid cancers coming along. And after 10 years, solid cancers and various other effects, particularly cardiovascular effects. That's what we expect to see in that timeline. Now, we already 2 years passed. So I've said here, within the first 9 months, are there any effects? Well, yes, there are. And it's due to a gentleman called Dr. Alfred Koerblein, who lives in Nuremberg, that we owe a great deal of thanks, because he's dug up the data, and this is what he's found. He found an infant peak in infant mortality about 6 weeks after the March the 11th, 2011. And Alexei showed this before, but we can, this peak here is quite significant. It shows that, I'll just go on to the next slide, it shows a threefold increase in infant mortality rate, which is statistically significant. Instead of the observed rate was about 9 per 1,000, and the expected was about 3, so a threefold increase. We're not absolutely sure what's going on here, but basically these infant deaths are an anomaly. We see them, and they've happened elsewhere. Now, there's a second event, and that is, effects, I should say, a decline in live birth numbers. And this happens 9 months after March the 11th. This is observable not only in Fukushima Prefecture, but also in the whole of Japan. In Fukushima, there was a reduction in the live birth numbers of 15%, and in all of Japan, about 5%. These are statistically significant. These are big enough numbers for us to know there's something going on here. Now, the next slide I'm going to be showing you the standardized residuals. We've looked at the data and turned it so that on its side so you can actually see it, of monthly data for Fukushima Prefecture. And you can see the number of live births 9 months later falls off a cliff. Yeah. After 9 months after the events in Fukushima. A good question you might want to ask is, well, did we see it elsewhere? Yeah, we do. On the left, you can see the slide for Fukushima Prefecture, and on the right, you can see Kiev City, which is this is after 9 months after Chernobyl. Yeah. Again, the number of live births fell off a cliff. So we've already seen effects, in utero effects or teratogenic effects. Another teratogenic effect, although it's rarely acknowledged as such, is infant leukemias. Way back in the 1950s and 60s, Alice Stewart, who was a personal friend of both Bob Alvarez and Kitty Tucker and myself, a wonderful, wonderful woman, she found in her Oxford Survey of Childhood Cancers that there was a 168% increase in leukemias. Sorry, wrong one. She found a doubling of the number of infant leukemia is born to women who were irradiated by x-rays during pregnancy. And in 1987, this was actually shown after Chernobyl. There was a 168% increase in Belarus infants. And this was spotted by, again, by Dr. Alfred Kerblein. In all of the slides, I've given you here the web addresses, so you can do your own digging and find it out. Yeah. By the way, that childhood leukemias or infant leukemias hasn't been studied yet at Fukushima, but it could be. I'm going to move now to adult leukemias, which we would expect to see, well, from now on, actually, 2 years after the event. That's when you begin to see adult leukemias. Adult leukemias were difficult to pick up at Chernobyl, but mainly because of you're looking for a small signal in an area where there's a lot of noise. But just recently, in January this month and this year, Jablotska did a study of over 110,000 Chernobyl liquidators. Liquidator is a technical term meaning people who go in and clean up the mess, and they're exposed to large amounts of radioactivity. Well, she found a linear dose response, and I'll show you the next slide. Now, this is really important because for a number of reasons. One is that it's a very clear evidence of leukemia increases. And it's, the results are statistically significant because even though the effect's small, you've got big, big numbers, let's just say 110,000 people. The amount of work they put into this was just amazing. Looking at case records for 110,000 people takes a long time. One of the significant things is if you look at the actual data points here, we're down to about 10, 15 millisieverts. So whenever anybody tells you, oh, there's no effects from radiation below 100 millisieverts, well, what a pile of, a crock of S, basically. Look at this stuff here. Just going on. Now, one of the things that we would expect after about 4 or 5 years are increases in thyroid cancer. Already, we've seen increases in cysts and nodules in children in Fukushima last year and this year. I've double-checked this with a number of scientists, what the significance of this, and I have to say that there's conflicting results, and it's basically hard to say what's actually going on here. All I can say is that, and this is the important thing, after 4 years, we're going to see increases in thyroid cancers. That's the key thing. Maybe not as much as, at Chernobyl, for this reason. At Chernobyl, all of the people there were had very low levels of iodine because they lived thousands of kilometers from the sea and they had not much fish in their diet. Whereas in Japan, all of the people live very near the sea and they all have very rich diets in fish and seaweed. So their thyroids were stacked up with stable iodine. Okay, and whereas in Chernobyl, they were starved of iodine, and when the radioactive iodine came out, they gobbled it up and took it in. So with any luck, the thyroid cancer incidence at Fukushima won't be as severe as occurred after Chernobyl. And it was severe after Chernobyl. This is data showing the epidemic of thyroid cancers in Belarus after Fukushima. And you see here, this is adults. And they don't say this in the chart, but it's adult women, almost totally. I don't want to steal the thunder of following speakers, but there's quite a clear gender difference here. Women really got it in terms of thyroid cancers after Chernobyl. Okay, better get on. But I mentioned earlier on about that we need to talk about population risks versus individual risks. There's a lot of emphasis on individual risks, but really we need to talk about population risks as well. As I mentioned, there's a reverse lottery going on, but real people will die. I want to now talk about, and finish off with, a few, because we know of these exposures from the fallout throughout Japan and elsewhere, you can make estimates of the number of people who will die from cancer. Once you've got the collective dose, you can multiply by a risk factor of, say, 10% per Siebert, and get an estimate of the number of fatal cancers. Now, there have been three studies so far. The French study by the Institut de Radioprotection et Sûreté Nucléaire, the first one. Tenhove and Jacobson out in the West Coast at Lawrence Livermore. And Jan Bia and Ed Lyman and Frank Van Hippel here in the East Coast. Frank's at Princeton. These three have made the following estimates. Frank, and by the way, I've corrected these data so that there's no draft applied, because one of the funny things from the WHO report was that they said we shouldn't be applying drafts. Draft is a fudge factor, and I don't have time to explain it. Basically, it reduced the number of deaths. And if you don't have to apply it, then the deaths go up. Frank Van Hippel said about maybe 1,500 deaths. The French government report said about 220. Tenhove and Jacobson said about 170. Jan Beya and his colleagues about 700. And I made my own study showing about 3,000 deaths. I'll be clear about this. This is from groundshine only. No internal doses, just groundshine. That was the cesium landing on the ground. But it's estimated over 70 years. That's how long the cesium will last, 70 years into the future. And if you compare that with Chernobyl, again, no draft, you can see the numbers are much larger, at least an order of magnitude, probably two orders of magnitude larger. I'm going to finish off on some citizen activist results. These are people who are not officials. They have no connection with the Japanese so-called radiation protection bodies. Professor Hayama, who at... at Hirata Central Hospital. He studied whole body counts. He put... of internal radiation, of people who, all the people who came into his hospital between October 2011 and November 2011. He wasn't paid to do this. He just did it himself because he was so concerned. 30,000 people is a lot of people. His measurement protocols were good. I double-checked them with colleagues in the UK. And the key thing that came out with was that, and this is encouraging news for the Japanese people here and people in Fukushima, is that there's been a decline in the number of people who tested positive for internal cesium. And that's we can take something forward from that, from 12% in 2011 down to 3% in 2012. That's really encouraging news. And after May 2012, no cesium detected in the children so far. And that's a big number. 10,000. That's good. That's Hirata is on the cusp of the horseshoe, if you can imagine the fallout plume. Just going very quickly. Another citizen scientist, they're called the SafeCast people, Asby Brown, if you happen to know him. Good bloke. A citizen scientist, no connection with officialdom. I trust them. They have glass badge data, which is like a film badge with a glass badge. And they showed was that the actual levels of external radiation are declining from here, 2011, down to 2012. The yellow bit here is the decline. In other words, the graph is moving to the left, showing that doses are going down. And that's, again, encouraging news. This is not TEPCO speaking. These are ordinary citizen scientists doing their own measurements, and I believe them. Big numbers as well. I haven't talked about internal radiation in terms of food here, but it's really encouraging that there's no fish allowed to be, all the fishing has been stopped. Big demonstrations, which is great. I'd like to finish off by saying that this is the words of George Santayana, a philosopher who said that governments and people who are unable to learn from history are condemned to repeat it. My thanks to these scientists. This has been a collaborative effort by a number of scientists, particularly Alfred Korblein, who we all owe a great deal of thanks. I noticed yesterday that there were a lot of questions, and oftentimes they weren't really satisfactorily answered, because of time. Can I point you to a bit of a shameless plug here, but to my website, which does have answers on collective doses of Fukushima, why WHO and UNSCEAR are wrong to try and discredit population doses, the new EPI studies, big studies showing risks at small doses, why we should still continue using LNT, and the lot of evidence on the below 100 millisieverts. This is what it's all about. The kids are taking the brunt of Fukushima. Our hearts go out to them. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Fairley. I think it's important to recognize that we have a word in medicine called iatrogenic, which is when we cause something ourselves. And what we've just seen is that Fukushima is just the latest example of how, from the atmospheric testing to Chernobyl and now Fukushima, we continue to do this to ourselves. And if we do not learn from this experience, we will continue to do it into the future.